sort of underlined what we can take away from Merchant of Venice, which may not have been what Shakespeare's audience took away from it. Unfortunately, they probably took away a lot of reinforced anti-Semitic tropes. But in this production, it really reinforced how one should consider Shylock's perspective.
So if you think that you shouldn't do Shakespeare just to do Shakespeare, what is your perspective on the people who do Shakespeare in, like, the most authentic way they possibly can, only casting men, making sure the costumes are pitch perfect? How does that play in?
Speaking of the Globe. I think it's an interesting idea. There are obviously some problems that you immediately run into. You listed one, which is that women did work in the early modern theater. Women's labor was crucial for the production of plays in early modernity. But it was very much a behind-the-scenes involvement. In the early modern period, no women appeared on stage. However, we have these great female characters. So, you know, kind of what gives? And it is an interesting, I think, exercise, not to mention research approach, to try to stage a play like Twelfth Night, for example, which may be the production you're thinking of, as was famously done at Shakespeare's Globe by the company there, starring Mark Rylance as Olivia, Johnny Flynn as Viola, and a perfectly classed Stephen Fry as Malvolio. It is an interesting exercise to see what the Olivia of Shakespeare's stage would have, could have, you know, with massive air quotes, should have looked like. It's just a research question, and sort of an interesting answer to that question. At the end of the day, though, that's just one other production of Twelfth Night, and one other reading of it, so to speak. I think if you're going to do something like that, you know, you have to be making sure that your theater is inclusive in other ways. And I think that it should probably be the exception, not the norm, for productions. That said, I do enjoy that production.
I'm sure everybody asks you this all the time, but what would you say is the real value? Because we've been talking about how to study Shakespeare, how to deal with all these implications in Shakespeare. But what is the value of studying Shakespeare at all?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it depends on... I think it's individual. I think it depends on who you are. The value will change depending on what you are want to get out of it. Personally, I think that these are very dramaturgically interesting plays. There are a lot of people who disagree with me, and I love that opinion. I would love to hear them say more about it, because I love hearing reasons why we should be doing maybe newer plays. I think that's very valid. But for me, I think there's a lot of dramaturgical potential. And by dramaturgical potential, I mean they're very malleable in a way that a lot of contemporary theater tends not to be, because it's very situational. But in a way that sort of was baked into early modern drama, and so I think that to people who might say, well, we're doing Shakespeare too much, the answer is not don't do early modern drama. It's do Shakespeare's contemporaries as well, because there's a lot there that is sort of not as commonplace as Shakespeare's works. So the works of Marlowe, Jonson, Lilly, to go back a decade to a more obscure playwright, perhaps. Those folks are also doing really interesting things, often much more sort of avant-garde than Shakespeare even. And then in terms of the value of reading and studying, I think that it is a great tool for especially young people to sort of understand, different perspectives, sort of the normal reasons that people say that everyone should read Shakespeare, but different perspectives, how language works, how poetry works, how to really craft a good insult in a conversation.
Absolutely.
to bring us back, all the way back. So I think that there is value. I do think that it should be balanced with other kinds of theater. You shouldn't just go see Shakespeare. You should also go see a brand new play. You should also see a play from the early 20th century. You should see a play in another language, even if you don't understand it. You should always go see theater.
Awesome. Well, this has been Forbes Avenue. I'm Rihanna Duncan. I've been talking with Elizabeth Dietrich about theater in the early modern era, now, even a bit of medieval stuff. Thank you so much for tuning in, and thank you for being here with us.
Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Democracy Now!
We'll be signing a historic agreement that will make the United States a major partner in developing Ukraine's minerals and rare earths and oil and gases, and we have a great understanding. I think it's going to be great for Ukraine. We're going to be at the site, and we'll be digging. We'll be digging. Dig we must.
President Trump's meeting at the White House today with Ukrainian President Zelensky to sign a deal to give the United States access to Ukraine's rare earth minerals. What is Ukraine getting in return? We'll look at the deal as well as the latest round of U.S.-Russia talks and the growing rift between the U.S. and Europe. Then unlawfully detained, tortured, and starved, the plight of Gaza's medical workers in Israeli custody. A new report by Physicians for Human Rights Israel accuses Israel of systematically imprisoning and abusing Palestinian doctors and medical staff from Gaza. Finally, we speak to the head of the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine about the group's efforts to preserve thousands of government web pages being deleted by the Trump administration.
Since the inauguration, we've seen large numbers of web sites and web pages taken offline. For example, if someone tries to find PDF documents on the tech.ed.gov website of the Department of Education, hundreds of them are simply not available anymore where they were before.
We'll speak with Mark Graham. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge in California ruled late Thursday President Trump and Elon Musk's mass firings of probationary government workers were illegal, siding with a coalition of labor unions and nonprofit groups. Judge William Alsup ordered the Office of Personnel Management to retract memos directing numerous agencies to fire an estimated total of 200,000 workers and to inform department heads that the OPM has no such authority. But he stopped short of ordering a halt to the firings, leaving that move up to the affected agencies. The news came just as a wave of layoffs was underway at NOAA. That's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Hundreds of probationary workers working on crucial climate and weather projects lost their jobs. It's not clear if Judge Alsup's ruling will lead to the reversal of those or any other firings. In related news, a federal judge in Virginia ruled the Trump administration can fire dozens of CIA and intelligence officers who worked on diversity programs, DEI. Earlier Thursday, the Trump administration announced it's cutting 90% of USAID's overseas contracts and $60 billion in U.S. assistance around the world. The move will terminate funding for critical polio, HIV, malaria, and nutrition programs, among other things. Thousands of USAID workers were given 15 minutes to clear out their desks. Peers and supporters greeted fired workers as they left the building.
I worry about the people that have gone this many days without food, without medicine, without the humanitarian assistance that we promised them.
Talk to the average American. Do they want to see people dying because of assistance cut off? You know, there would have been a very clear and particular way to reform the foreign assistance sector in this country, to reform USAID. And frankly, a lot of people sort of wanted to see that.
The Trump administration canceled a planned FDA meeting of the Federal Vaccine Advisory Committee next month that was set to determine the composition of next season's flu shots. It's the second canceled vaccine panel meeting since Robert F. Kennedy Jr. became Health and Human Services Secretary. To see our interview with a pediatrician in Texas where there's a measles outbreak, go to democracynow.org. Beijing pledged to retaliate after Trump said the U.S. would slap another 10% tariff increase on Chinese goods starting Tuesday, March 4th. Trump also said Thursday 25% tariffs on goods from Canada and Mexico will go into effect Tuesday after a one-month pause. Both Canada and Mexico have vowed retaliatory tariffs. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum says her government is still in talks with the U.S. in hopes of heading off a trade war.
Sabemos que el presidente Trump...
We know President Trump has his way of communicating and setting negotiation timings and joint work. We must think we can reach an agreement.
This comes as European nations slam Trump's 25% tariff threat on European Union goods as irresponsible and blasted Trump's comments Thursday.
I mean, look, let's be honest. The European Union was formed in order to screw the United States. That's the purpose of it. And they've done a good job of it, but now I'm president.
Meanwhile, President Trump indicated the UK would be spared from any sort of U.S.-instigated trade war as he met with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer at the White House Thursday. We'll have more on that meeting after headlines. During Starmer and Trump's Oval Office meeting, Trump also appeared to soften his stance on Ukraine, saying he has a lot of respect for the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, a man he had called a dictator. He also suggested the president the presence of U.S. workers in Ukraine to exploit rare earth minerals would provide security from Russian troops. Trump was asked about his recent remarks calling Zelensky a dictator.
Mr. President, do you still think that Mr. Zelensky is a dictator?
Did I say that? I can't believe I said that. Next question.
President Zelensky is meeting with Trump at the White House today. Hamas is calling on the international community to put pressure on Israel as Gaza ceasefire talks resume in Cairo, and the first phase of the agreement is set to expire Saturday. On Thursday, Israel released, after a delay, the remaining 46 Palestinian prisoners of the latest captive swap. 24 of them were children. This is Nida Abu Sahlul, mother of one of the released children.
Muhammad has been detained for 420 days. He has spent the second birthday in prison. Please be to God that he was released after all this wait.
In Israel, an internal probe has acknowledged the military's complete failure to prevent Hamas's October 7th attacks, which killed over 1,000 people and saw another 200 taken hostage. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot and killed another Palestinian child. 16-year-old Hamid Mohammed Fadel Nazal was shot near the northern Qalqilya checkpoint. Here in the United States, Axios is reporting House Foreign Affairs Chair Brian Mast has instructed Republican committee staff to refer to the West Bank by its Hebrew name Judea and Samaria. It's the latest attempt to deny Palestinians rights in the Israeli-occupied territory. In Turkey, the jailed Kurdish rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan has called on his followers in the PKK, that's the Kurdistan Workers' Party, to lay down arms and dissolve their organization, paving the way for the first ceasefire since a peace process collapsed in 2015. Since 1984, Turkey's waged a counterinsurgency campaign against the PKK in Turkey's Kurdish-dominated southeast region, where fighting has killed more than 40,000 people. Meanwhile, the commander of the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces group, which controls northeastern Syria, said Öcalan's directive does not apply to his organization.
بالطبع يعني بالطبع يجبو بجاري بجاري PKK على قدر ذيك وبنجوز.
This issue is related to the PKK, the issue of laying down arms, and it has nothing to do with us, and it is not directed at us and our forces. But if this operation succeeds, we will also benefit from it, because Turkey has concerns about the PKK, and because of the PKK, Turkey is attacking our regions, and because the PKK will dissolve itself and lay down its arms, then there will be no danger to Turkey, and there will be no excuse to attack our regions.
Turkey's military has repeatedly attacked Kurdish forces in Syria, including the People's Protection Units, or YPG, which Turkey considers part of the PKK. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, at least 11 people were killed, dozens injured after explosions at a mass rally held by the Rwanda-backed M23 group in Bukavu. M23 leaders accused Congolese security forces of orchestrating the attack. Survivors described the chaotic scene.
A plastic bag was thrown in front of us over there. We didn't know what was inside. We were just looking at it. Suddenly, there was an explosion. Boom! Poof! We fell to the ground and ran away.
Some 7,000 people have been killed by the escalating violence since January, with hundreds of thousands displaced from their homes. To see our coverage of the DRC, go to democracynow.org. Thailand's deported 40 Uyghur asylum seekers to China, ignoring warnings from human rights groups that they'll likely face torture and imprisonment if returned. The group of asylum seekers fled China, seeking protection in Thailand, where they were instead arrested in 2014 and detained for over a decade. This is UN High Commissioner for Human Rights spokesperson Liz Throssell.
Their deportation violates the principle of non-refoulement, for which there is a complete prohibition in cases where there is a real risk of torture, ill treatment, or other irreparable harm upon their return.
China has been accused of human rights abuses against Uyghur Muslims that may amount to crimes against humanity. In news from Europe, Austria's three main centrist parties reached a deal Thursday to form a new ruling coalition without involving the far-right Freedom Party that won Austria's parliamentary elections 5 months ago. Meanwhile, Germany's conservative Christian Democratic Union, which won last Sunday's elections, and the center-left Socialist Democratic Party are launching coalition talks today. The far-right AfD, Alternative for Germany Party, came in second place, but all other parties have ruled out forming a coalition with the AfD. World leaders have agreed to establish a global fund aimed at protecting biodiversity and preventing the worst impacts of nature loss by 2030. The deal by negotiators at the UN Biodiversity Summit in Rome, known as COP16, came after days of marathon negotiations. The deal comes as global wildlife populations have plunged by more than 70% over the last 40 years, largely due to human activity. Questions remain on the establishment of the fund and the commitment from global North nations, which are largely responsible for the worsening climate crisis. Back in the U.S., the House and Senate voted to overturn an EPA rule that would have required oil companies to pay fees for emitting methane, a potent greenhouse gas known as a superpollutant. The measure came as part of 2022's Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, but had not yet gone into effect. The rule was expected to bring in billions of dollars. Elon Musk has called for the cancellation of Verizon's $2.4 billion contract to upgrade the Federal Aviation Administration's air traffic control system, following reports the FAA is close to reassigning the work to Musk's own internet satellite company, Starlink. Last week, Musk shipped about 4,000 Starlink terminals to the FAA. That prompted criticism from many, including Massachusetts Democratic Senator Ed Markey, who said the move, quote, creates an appearance of a conflict of interest. Last month, Trump's Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy announced he'd assigned SpaceX engineers to modernize U.S. air traffic control systems following the deadly crash of an American Airlines flight as it approached Washington, D.C.'s Reagan National Airport. In Iowa, Hundreds of protesters took to the Capitol building in Des Moines to defend trans rights as lawmakers passed an unprecedented bill stripping civil rights protections based on gender identity. Iowa State Representative Amy Wickendall, the first transgender woman elected to Iowa's legislature, spoke out against the bill from the House floor.
This bill revokes protections to our jobs, our homes, and our ability to access credit. In other words, it deprives us of our life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. I bring this up because the purpose of this bill and the purpose of every anti-trans bill is to further erase us from public life and to stigmatize our existence. The sum total of every anti-trans and anti-LGBTQ bill is to make our existence illegal.
A self-described misogynist who's accused by Romanian authorities of human trafficking and rape has arrived in the United States after the Trump administration lifted travel restrictions on him. Andrew Tate, a far-right social media influencer and prominent Trump supporter, returned to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Thursday, along with his brother Tristan, who also faces human trafficking charges in Romania. The pair's return came after Romania's foreign minister told the AP a Trump administration official expressed interest in the brothers' case at the recent Munich security conference. Here in New York, two men were pronounced dead just hours apart Wednesday at a maximum security prison in Westchester County as a wildcat strike by guards across dozens of prisons in the state continues for a second week. Anthony Douglas, who was 67, and 35-year-old Franklin Dominguez were both found unresponsive in their cells inside the Sing Sing Correctional Facility. Their death comes days after 61-year-old Jonathan Grant was also found dead at another prison where guards have walked off the job. To see our interview on the wildcat strike and what's happening to prisoners inside Attica and other prisons, go to democracynow.org. And consumers across the U.S. are taking part in a 24-hour economic blackout today. The campaign organized by the People's Union is urging U.S. customers to refrain from shopping, in particular from major corporations like Amazon and Walmart, in order to, quote, take back control of our economy, government, and future of our country, unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump's meeting at the White House today with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to sign a deal to give the United States access to Ukraine's rare earth minerals. But details of the deal remain unclear, including what Ukraine gets in exchange. Today's meeting comes just over a week after Trump accused Zelensky of being a dictator. But on Thursday, Trump appeared to back off the charge when questioned by a reporter.
Did I say that? I can't believe I said that. Next question.
President Trump made the comment while meeting at the White House with the British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. On Thursday, Trump also talked about the mineral deal with Ukraine.
We'll be signing a historic agreement that will make the United States a major partner in developing Ukraine's minerals and rare earths and oil and gases, and we have a great understanding. I think it's going to be great for Ukraine. We're going to be at the site, and we'll be digging. We'll be digging. Dig we must. The American taxpayers will now effectively be reimbursed for the money and hundreds of billions of dollars poured into helping Ukraine defend itself, which by and of itself is a very worthy thing to do. Additionally, the minerals agreement will provide the basis for a more sustainable future relationship between the United States and Ukraine, and thus stimulate the long-term prosperity that will help the Ukrainians rebuild their country. It's been demolished.
This all comes as a rift is growing between the United States and Europe as the Trump administration moves closer to Russia. On Thursday, U.S. and Russian diplomats met in Turkey for another round of talks as momentum grows to end the war in Ukraine. But many questions remain about what a peace deal could look like. We're joined in Washington, D.C. by Matt Duss, Executive Vice President, Center for International Policy, former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. His recent piece for The Guardian is headlined, "What Are We to Make of Trump's Ukraine Policy?" Matt, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about what you understand at this point. At the time of this broadcast, the meeting between Zelensky and Trump has not taken place at the White House yet.
Right. Well, what we understand, what I understand right now is that a few weeks ago, this deal on rare earth minerals actually originated with the Ukrainians in the hopes that this would be a way to entice Donald Trump into offering U.S. security guarantees. They understand, I think quite rightly, that Donald Trump is always interested in how he can profit, how he can cut deals. And the hope was that in exchange for some claim to Ukraine's rare earth mineral wealth, this would translate into real military security guarantees from the United States to Ukraine's security. Donald Trump responded to that by saying, "I love this idea. I'm not going to give you any real security guarantees." However, he does seem to imply that by giving the United States a stake in the future in future profits in Ukraine, this in itself could translate into a form of security guarantee. He has talked about U.S. workers being present doing this work in Ukraine as a form of a guarantee, but believing that would also mean that Donald Trump, the United States, would respond militarily to an attack by Russia that endangered those Americans. So this is still unclear, as are the actual details of this minerals deal.
So, I mean, it's very interesting because you'd think the person who's most concerned about this, I mean, Zelensky, for reasons of just how much of the rare earth minerals they would be promising to the U.S., but the person who would be most concerned about this is the president of Russia, Putin.
I mean, I think that's right. He obviously does not want the United States and Ukraine to be drawing into a closer relationship. So, again, this is why I say we really do need to wait and see the actual details of this deal. As of right now, it has Ukraine promising to invest some portion of their mineral wealth into a shared fund between Ukraine and the United States, and which would also be reinvested in Ukraine, although U.S. companies would be the ones developing this. Donald Trump sees this as a way of getting the United States, quote, paid back for its support for Ukraine's defense. But you're right. Anything that draws the U.S. and Ukraine closer is something that can't make Vladimir Putin very happy.
During his first cabinet meeting this week, President Trump was asked by reporters about tariffs on the European Union. And I'm asking you this as Trump just met, of course, with the British Prime Minister Starmer. They also talked about Ukraine. But this is particularly interesting, what he said, what Trump said about the European Union.
Formed in order to screw the United States. That's the purpose of it. And they've done a good job of it, but now I'm president.
What President Trump just said, the beginning was cut off, is that the EU, the European Union, was formed to screw the United States. Can you talk about the history and what Trump is talking about?
He, from his perspective, he clearly sees the EU as a way to just form a larger economic bloc that could compete with and possibly, as he said it, screw the United States. But obviously, it's much more complicated than that. Economic competition is part of it. I mean, coming out of World War II, there was a huge security and political component of this. Europe trying to draw together to coordinate and to talk more effectively to avoid a third round. We went through two world wars, driven by Europe. European economic and military competition. So it was a real effort to avoid that. But Donald Trump simply sees it as a way, as he said, to screw the United States by, you know, separate European countries drawing together into one large economic formation that could make joint economic decisions.
And so now President Trump is threatening tariffs starting Tuesday on Mexico, on Canada, increased tariffs on China, and threatening to tariff the whole European Union.
Right. I mean, he did this in his first term. He sees tariffs as, yet another way to extract concessions. It's hard to know exactly how far he's going to go, as we saw in his comments just now about Zelensky. Last week, he was calling Zelensky a dictator. This week, he can't believe he said that. You know, frankly, I can't believe he said that either. So we'll have to wait and see what he actually does. I think what's interesting about all these meetings we've been seeing from European leaders, Macron last week and Starmer just yesterday, and I'm sure we'll see this from Zelensky today, is that they all understand that they do not want to be in public spats with Donald Trump. They're seeking ways to flatter him. They're seeking ways to demonstrate that he can profit from a better relationship with their countries.
In your recent piece for The Guardian, where you talk about what are we to make of Trump's Ukraine policy, you talk about discussions between the U.S. and Moscow and deciding the future of Ukraine. You also compare this to U.S.-Israel relations as both nations plan the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from Gaza. So if you can talk about, in both cases, the first, leaving out Ukraine, though he's meeting with Zelensky today and denying he said, of course, he did say that Zelensky's a dictator, but leaving out Ukraine and leaving out the Palestinians when it comes to their fate.
Right. I mean, I see, you know, a great deal of similarity, you know, a consistency to Trump's approach. He sees, you know, the global order as one in which great powers, powerful countries make the decisions, and less powerful countries, less powerful communities and peoples simply have to live with the consequences. We saw that in his, you know, the negotiation between the United States and Russia, hosted by Saudi Arabia, where, you know, Russia and the United States were essentially determining the future of Ukraine. We saw this in the appearance at the White House with Benjamin Netanyahu a few weeks ago, where he announced his, you know, proposal for the removal, essentially the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, a decision with huge consequences for the Palestinian people and for the region, made without a Palestinian in sight. So again, I think this is how Trump sees the world, the United States, by dint of its enormous economic and military power, sits with other great powers and simply determines the rules of the road, and weaker countries and other peoples who aren't in the room have to deal with it.
Finally, you saw this video, AI-generated video, that President Trump retweeted on his social media on Truth Social. This horrific video about Gaza, and it has Trump Gaza, a huge hotel. It has a gold statue of President Trump. It has Elon Musk walking down the streets, and it has the Netanyahu and Trump sitting on beach chairs on the ocean with their cocktails. And finally, it has Trump dancing with a almost completely naked, her bottom naked woman. What is this?
I don't have a good answer for you. I don't know who dropped acid and made that video.
The point isn't who really made it. The point is he tweeted it.
That's right. No, that's right. You know, it is, it's, you know, clearly that appealed to him. But I mean, we saw this from his comments with Netanyahu, is that he sees, you know, the redevelopment, as he would say it, of Gaza as a source of potential profit, just as he sees this deal on rare earth minerals with Ukraine as a source of potential profit. In both of these cases, you always have to follow the money. The thing that to ask about every decision Donald Trump makes is, how does this translate into money in Donald Trump's pocket? So he clearly sees some advantage into this, you know, this garish redevelopment of Gaza into, you know, one big Trump casino and golf course, of course, without any consideration for the people who actually live there right now.
Matt Duss, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Vice President, Center for International Policy, former Foreign Policy Advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, and we'll link to your piece in The Guardian. Next up, we go to Ramallah and Gaza to speak with a detained doctor who just got out. And we'll talk about a new report called Unlawfully Detained, Tortured, and Starved, the Plight of Gaza's Medical Workers in Israeli Custody. Where is Dr. Abu Safia, from the head of the Kamel Adwan Hospital, taken by the Israeli military? Many thought he'd be released in this release of Palestinian prisoners, but he's nowhere to be found in that group. Stay with us. Lullaby for Faith by the Russian anti-war singer and composer Vadim Stroykin. The Guardian reports he died earlier this month after reports that Russian security services visited him in his apartment to investigate claims he donated to the Ukrainian army, and they claimed he jumped out of the window. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Negotiations between Israel and Hamas have begun in Cairo, Egypt, over the next phase of the Gaza ceasefire. In recent weeks, Hamas has released 33 Israeli hostages in return for some 2,000 Palestinians imprisoned in Israel. We turn now to look at a new report by Physicians for Human Rights Israel titled Unlawfully Detained, Tortured and Starved, The Plight of Gaza's Medical Workers in Israeli Custody. The report documents how Israel systematically imprisoned and abused Palestinian doctors and medical staff from Gaza. The list of jailed Palestinian doctors include the Gaza pediatrician, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, who was detained at Kamel Adwan Hospital in December. Many in Gaza had hoped he would be among those freed this week, but he remains in Israeli detention. This is a recently freed Palestinian prisoner named Hakim describing what Dr. Abu Safia has been exposed to in detention.
Dr. Hussam was beaten, especially Dr. Hussam and us, the medical staff, out of all other captives. They beat us, cursed at us, and starved us, and they started punching him. Are you the doctor? Come here. And they beat him. We were under the impression that he was released, but apparently, and according to you, he still hasn't been freed. We call upon all those concerned with this matter. Dr. Hussam established and built the healthcare system. He's its pillar. Dr. Hussam is the pillar of the healthcare system in the northern Gaza Strip. He resisted, and despite the lack of treatment, he remained steadfast. When the entire medical staff was injured, he remained steadfast. We thought that we were going to hell, to death. There are places over there that are named after hell.
We're joined right now by Naji Abbas, the director of the Prisoners Department, Physicians for Human Rights Israel. He collected the testimonies for the group's new report, Unlawfully Detained, Tortured and Starved, The Plight of Gaza's Medical Workers in Israeli Custody. And in Gaza, we are joined by Dr. Khaled Al-Ser, renowned Palestinian surgeon at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. He was jailed by Israel for 7 months last year. He says he was beaten, humiliated, denied medical treatment, and tortured. No charges were filed against him. Dr. Al-Ser was abducted by Israeli forces during a raid on Gaza's Nasser Hospital last March. At the time, he was one of the last remaining general surgeons in the hospital. Dr. Al-Ser is also the lead author of the August 2024 report in The Lancet, headlined Trauma Care Supported Through a Global Telemedicine Initiative During the 2023-24 Military Assault on the Gaza Strip, Occupy Palestinian Territory, a case series. At the time of publication, the medical journal The Lancet put lead author whereabouts currently unknown. Dr. Khaled Al-Ser, we're going to begin with you in Gaza, outside the hospital where you work. You were recently released from Israeli detention. Can you explain what happened to you?
Hello to you and to your audience. It happened to me last March 24. I was working in this hospital after it has been destructed by the Israeli army, IDF. They destroyed all of the department. At that time, we tried to reopen the hospital again, trying to clean the floors, clean the department, trying to open it as a medical point, at least to receive casualty. Back in March, there was a lot of threats against Palestine and Rafah, that Netanyahu threat that he will invade Rafah. We tried to prepare the hospital to receive casualty at that time. When we surprised that the soldiers invaded the whole city and the hospital zone within 1 hour, shooting anyone walking in the street, and they brought a siege around the hospital for 2 days. After that, they ordered us to go outside the building, and they ordered us to take off our clothes, and they brought us naked, handcuffed from behind with plastic tie, and they handcuffed. They put plastic on our ankles with blindfolds over our eyes, and they kept us under interrogation here near the hospital in a civilian building for 5 days under continuous interrogation from their soldiers. At that time, I have been asked several questions. All of them are related to my job. They did not know anything about me. They don't know Khaled. They only asked one question. They asked me about is my job as a general surgeon here at Nasser Hospital, what I did during the war inside the hospital. And after that, this was the only question they decided to take me to the prison for.
So can you explain where you were taken to, Dr. Alsed? Explain the interrogations you went through.
I underwent interrogation like 5 times, 2 times here in the hospital on field during the invasion of the soldier to the hospital zone. And after that, they took me in a military vehicle going toward Israel. During my stay inside the prison, I did not know anything about my position, which prison I am in, except with one time when I have a visit from my lawyer who told me that I was in DT Man prison for 3 months. And after that, they sent me on 18th of June to offer military camp prison. It's all of these in prisons are in new prisons developed or established during the October 7 war. And most of the prisoners I meet inside the prison are civilians or civil workers here working inside hospitals, school, universities. During the interrogation here in the field and inside the prison, they took me 3 times to the interrogation. All of their questions related to the hospital, to the department in the hospital, if I saw any hostage inside the hospital, and that's all. And even after 2 months, before any interrogation inside the hospital, they decided to make like a fake court for me. They took me outside the prison in DT Man. I was in DT Man. They called my name. They took me outside the prison, handcuffed from behind, and they covering my eye with a piece of cloth. And they put me in the chair, and after they removed the blindfold, I was surprised with a video call on the phone, someone telling me that you are now in a court and you are charged to be a terrorist, to be inside the prison until the end of the war. Without any prior announcement, I go with the man who was talking with me that I did not have any legal consultation. I did not have a chance to call any lawyer, but they ignore anything we talk. They want to take the picture and the video for us, charging us with a fake charge. And actually, I did not have an actual interrogation or an actual saying for me before this court. In June, they took me twice to the interrogation with the same question. All of them regarded my work at Nasser Hospital during the war in the general surgery department.
Can you talk about who ran the prison and how they punish prisoners? Are we talking about the notorious Stay Teman, or were you also at Ofer? Can you talk about what I was reading about your testimony, beatings and unleashing pepper spray in the face?
If I want to talk about the brutality of the soldiers inside this DT Man, I will take more than 1 day or 2 days speaking in details about their brutality. In short, anyone inside DT Man at least once faced beating by batons, bar fists, kicking, or even get bitten by the dogs. They enter every 1 week or twice weekly. They have a false 100. They enter without a prior warning or announcement inside the place. It's not a prison, just an open area closed with a metallic fence. They enter this area with 100 prisoners. They order all the prisoners on their tummy, and after that they choose randomly anyone inside the prison to beat him with a baton or to spray him with a pepper spray. And sometimes I heard a lot of testimony from prisoners inside the prison. They came to me seeking a medical advice because they have sexually assaulted by the soldiers using baton and sometimes using the electrical guns in their sensitive areas. And sometimes they spray their faces and their private parts by pepper spray. All of this happened to me. Every 1 week we have one incident of invasion of these force to our stay inside Diti Man.
And I mean, right now, we were trying to reach you all day yesterday. You're doing operation after operation. Right in front of you is the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. You were held in prison for a number of months. During your stay, you met other doctors, Dr. Mohammed Shahada, Dr. Wael Abdelhadi, and Dr. Iyas Elbersh. Isn't Dr. Iyas Elbersh the relative of the well-known doctor who was found, whose body was found dead at Ofer military, at Ofer prison, Dr. Adnan Elbersh?
Yes, they are relative. Dr. Elias Elbersh is a volunteer doctor. He was working in a Shifa. I have a chance to meet him inside Sditi Man and also inside Ofer camp. I met Elias Elbersh. He's a relative of Dr. Elbersh, who was killed inside Ofer. He has been released recently, I think, and also Dr. Mahmoud Shahada has been released. But till now, after more than 1 year of invasion of Nasser Complex, Nasser Hospital, we still have a lot of medical staff inside the prison. We are awaiting them to be released soon. One of them, Dr. Nahed Abu Ta'ima, is the lead and the head of the surgical building behind me. He's the head of all surgical departments. Also, Dr. Ghassan Abu Zuhri, the head of the orthopedic department. They were captured and detained back in February 24. And till now, we are still waiting their release because no actual charge has been written against them.
Finally, what message do you have for the world, Dr. Khaled Al-Alsa? Many families were hoping missing doctor and medical staff would be released in the latest prisoner exchange. It was thought that Dr. Abu Safiya, well-known head of Kamal Adwan, the pediatrician, would be released. There's been video shown of him, but he hasn't been. What's your message to the world, recently freed, right back in the hospital performing operations, Dr. Alsa?
Speaking on behalf of all of the health worker who has been either injured, detained during this war, or all of my colleagues who has been killed during this war, we as healthcare worker, we don't have any agenda against anyone. We just provide medical care for all civilians, for anyone coming to the hospital seeking for the help, for our help. I remember back in January and February, I was here, the only surgeon, the last hope for all patients in Khan Yunis city, trying to rescue our patients. So we don't have any military or any agenda behind doing our work. So please do your effort to all the international committee to do your effort to get released all of my colleagues inside the prison who are still now without any charge, kept in detention. And actually, it's not detention. They are kidnapped. And actually, they are kidnapped. They are not in a human situation or human suitable situation inside the prison. So please, as soon as possible, do your effort to get them all out free within us.
Dr. Khaled Al-Asad, I want to thank you so much for stepping outside the hospital and talking to us today. Palestinian surgeon at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, who was jailed for months at the notorious Deir Teman and then Ufa prison, recently released. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now from Gaza to the occupied West Bank, to Ramallah, where we're joined by Nadia Abbas, director of the Prisoners Department at Physicians for Human Rights Israel. The group's new report headlined, Unlawfully Detained, Tortured, and Starved, the Plight of Gaza's Medical Workers in Israeli Custody. If you can talk about the scope of your report, Nadia Abbas, what you found. And then I want to ask you about Dr. Abu Safia as well.
Good afternoon, Amy, and for Dr. Khaled. Actually, the address of our report can give you a direct picture to our findings. When we call it unlawfully detained, we are based on testimonies, and we have testimonies more than we published that show the same pattern and the same story that Dr. Khaled described just now. All the doctors, also including Dr. Abu Safia, are facing the same situation, being brutally arrested without any cause from their workplaces because they are doctors, interrogating through torture, beating, violence, sexual abuse, being held without any charges, without any proper legal procedure, in a horrific conditions, including torture. We know torture before to get information, but here torture are being used in every day of the detention journey. It's a whole journey of torture and abuse, using the starvation policies, denial of medical care. So we tried in the address to give a direct picture to our all findings from the all of the testimonies that we got.
Nanji, you assert that the medical workers have been targeted for the very fact of their profession. Explain.
First of all, there is the numbers of the healthcare workers who were arrested. We are speaking about hundreds. From the first invasion to Al-Shifa Hospital, and after that, Nasser Hospital, Al-Mamadani Hospital, and Kamal Idwan lately, we saw a pattern of attacking the health system in Gaza. And in every invasion, we heard about dozens of healthcare workers, staff of these hospitals, these facilities, being taken away by the Israeli soldiers. And we didn't know, we tried to find out what they are looking for besides destroying the buildings of the hospitals, why they are taking the whole staff, the medical staff. So in through the testimonies, through our visits, we started to understood that the doctors were arrested mainly for collecting information. When you hear a doctor saying that he was forced to draw a map of the hospital, when he was asked about his colleagues, when he was asked if you can understand that there is a pattern of questioning, looking, fishing for information, and they weren't accused or charged with anything. All of the doctors, more than 100 medical staff who still till now in detention, have the same story of Dr. Khaled. They weren't charged or accused as individual with any offense, but all the interrogation were collecting information about their workplace, about their colleagues, about the health system in Gaza. And you, beside the doctors who were arrested inside the hospitals, we met doctors who were arrested through checkpoints of the Israeli army inside Gaza when they were trying to move with their families. So when the soldier heard that he's a doctor, he was arrested. So you can understand that they were targeted directly because of their profession.
Your report also details incidents of sexual assault including the insertion of batons and electric rods into the buttocks, leaving signs of burns or injuries. In fact, Dr. Khaled has talked about treating at least three prisoners when he was in prison with such injuries while they were detained.
That's right. All the testimonies described, as I said, the horrific conditions, horrific daily beating, the daily beating without any cause, without anything happening before. When you hear more than one doctor, like in Zdeti Man, they all started to know the detainees. The doctors started to know the unit names that stormed to the section where they are being held at, or it's not a section. When they call Zdeti Man, through the testimonies, you can see that the doctors are calling it Baraksat. Baraksat is something like a staple. It's not a section, it's not a prison. It's a military camp, and there are staples, actually, that people are being held at, including the doctors. So you hear about the brutal violence of this unit called Unit 100. And actually, some of these units are accused, and that after that was revealed, that they raped, actually, some of the detainees in the last summer. That was revealed in the media. And this same unit entered every week, every 2 days, with dogs, beating, letting the dogs attack the doctors and the other detainees without any cause, without any cause, without any logic reason to try to understand what they are looking for through these policies. But you can understand, it's just a way of torturing people.
30 seconds on Dr. Abu Safia. We've recently seen video of him since we did not know where he was. He's been detained, head of Kamal Adwan. Naji, what do you know?
We don't know a lot. We know that Dr. Abu Safia in the first month disappeared, as all the doctors. Dr. Khaled Sir disappeared actually for 4 months. And Dr. Abu Safia the same. He disappeared for 1 month. We didn't know anything, where he was, in what conditions, why he are being detained. We didn't know anything. We know now that he's in Ofer prison. Just one lawyer managed to visit him. PHR lawyers are not allowed yet to visit him. We know that he was held in isolation, in solitary confinement, for 25 days. With a cell alone, with disconnected to the outside world, and Dr. Abu Safia, as all the doctors, all the healthcare workers, nurses, and doctors and paramedics, are not accused with anything, but you can see that the Israeli media is like interrogating Dr. Abu Safia on media reports and accusing him with things that, on reality and in the Israeli media, he wasn't accused at. He wasn't accused with an offense that he did. But the Israeli media, this propaganda of the Israeli media and the Israeli authorities, is part of the targeting of the medical staff trying to accuse the whole Gaza healthcare system that take its protection, the protection that the healthcare system and these medical personnel have by the international law, taking this away through media reports.
Naji Abbas, I want to thank you for being with us. Yes, you see him with helmeted guards through a prison in shackles, appearing exhausted. His family condemned the video broadcast, saying, "We reject any media outlet publishing the video without addressing the psychological terrorism involved in exposing the manipulation of his statements." Naji Abbas, director of the Prisoners Department at Physicians for Human Rights Israel, will link to your new report, Unlawfully Detained, Tortured, and Starved, the Plight of Gaza's Medical Workers in Israeli Custody. Coming up next, we speak with the head of the Wayback Machine. Thousands of government web pages are being deleted. What is happening? Back in 15 seconds. Thank you. Dev Campe, Haiti, Get Back Up, by the Haitian musician, composer, journalist Jean Pierre, once a guest on Democracy Now. He's died at the age of 71. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with Mark Graham, director of the Wayback Machine at the Internet Archive. Look at efforts to preserve thousands of government web pages being deleted by the Trump administration. In this first part of our interview that we do, Mark, if you can tell us what exactly is happening.
Sure. Let me first give a little bit of context. The Internet Archive is a nonprofit digital library with a mission of universal access to all knowledge. About 28 years ago, the founder of the Internet Archive, Brewster Kahle, pressed record on a new media called the web. And we've been working very hard every day since, getting better at doing just that, archiving much of the public web. We archive more than the web. We archive books and television news and microfiche and microfilm and academic papers, and I could go on and on. But the bread and butter of the operation here and through the Wayback Machine is archiving the public web. What I think we want to focus on today is efforts around archiving and making available material from the U.S. government. So in 2004 and every 4 years since, we have, in collaboration with others, focused on archiving much of what is published by the U.S. government before and after each presidential election. This is referred to as the end of term archive. You can read more about this by going to eotarchive.org. So every 4 years, we do a deep dive on tens of thousands of government websites and millions of pages. So this last time around, we endeavored to do this. We compiled a list of web pages and websites in collaboration with the Library of Congress, the National Archives and Records Administration, and the U.S. Government Publishing Office. So we have this. We had this big list, and before the election, we went through and we worked to archive as much of that material as we could. That was phase one. We did a second phase after the election. And we're now involved in a third phase of this work, which we started post-inauguration.
So can you tell us about what you understand the Trump administration is doing right now, removing thousands of pages related to diversity and gender ideology, as they say, as well as targeted scientific research and environmental justice data?
Yeah, absolutely. There have been thousands and thousands of pages removed. Many websites, for example, the USAID site, if you go to it right now, it just basically tells you how you can get your materials if you had been an employee there. A site called reproductiverights.gov. I could go on. Many, many sites are just gone. And then, like I said, at least 8,000, we actually don't know the number at this time, web pages have been removed. And these are web pages that deal with topics like education and health issues, climate change, aviation, weather. There was even a web page on the White House website about the U.S. Constitution that's not there anymore. And so the good news is that we've gotten pretty good at this effort. We, as I said, had done a very thorough job of archiving this material. I should also say that we do this work in collaboration with many other organizations. This end-of-term archive is a team effort. We work with Harvard's Library Innovation Lab, the University of North Texas, Stanford Libraries, the Common Crawl Foundation, and EDGE, Environmental and Data Governance Initiative. And I want to highlight the work of EDGE because what they have historically done is after the fact, after a change of presidential administration, they've gone in and tried to analyze what in fact had changed when the new administration came in. So they're deep in doing that work now. We also,
as we have 20 seconds for this segment, Mark.
Excellent. Okay. So, you know, I'd say the Wayback Machine is available to anyone. It's a free public service
at web.archive.org. Will it stay up?
It's stayed up for 28 years, and we're pretty sure it's going to stay up for at least 28 more.
So, Mark,
absolutely.
We want you to stay with us. This is all too important. Mark Graham is the director of the Wayback Machine at the Internet Archive, also part of the end-of-term archive for federal websites. We'll do part two, web exclusive, posted online. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM, and available on the internet at wrct.org.
I don't know what I'm gonna do with my life. It's not fair, it's not right. I wasn't born to just endure all this strife.
Kenny Joe here. You're in Pinckney Hall on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. You were just listening to Layla McCalla doing her song The Capitalist Blues off of the CD by the same name. Layla was not born in New Orleans, but she's one of a numerous list of musicians who have decided to live in New Orleans. At least last time I checked, Layla was there. And as you might have suspected, that's